Hello, short film fans, and welcome to In the Green Room, the podcast that brings you interviews from the filmmakers and actors behind the incredible movies on Cameo Launch Short Film Cinema. My name's Nigel Morgan, and I'm very happy to welcome you to the very first edition of In the Green Room, where we were lucky enough to speak to writer-director Drew Lovett and producer Diana Bruce on their short film, Insomnia. Insomnia is a psychological drama that follows Sarah, a young woman played by Erin Shaniger, who is struggling to cope with the aftermath of a traumatic and life-changing event. We follow Sarah as she attempts to confront the ghosts of her past and as the horrific events that caused her downward spiral is finally revealed. We sat down with Drew and Dana to get a little bit of background on the inspirations behind this film and their experiences when making it. Have a listen. Director Drew Lovett and producer Dana Bruce of the film Insomnia. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
And yeah, so we just wanted to have a bit of a chat about your experiences making the film, and if we could start off by just having a bit of background on the origins of Northern Giant Productions and how you came to be working together.
Well, I think it's best to kind of say about the origins of Insomnia, because that ties in with the origins of Northern Giant, and that's how me and Dana came to work together. So it was just a film that I'd kind of come across at university. It was part of a module that we're doing, and we'd given scripts and we had to make some short films, and I got given a script that was called, I don't think it was called Insomnia actually at the time, I think it was just about a character who had insomnia and about what they got up to in the just their day really, and the main thing when reading it was it didn't have any backstory to the character, to the reason why that character had insomnia and what had happened in the past to make up the person they are at the present when we see them in the film. So that's the kind of I kind of rewrote it and then made a version of it at university, and it did really well, but it wasn't, there was technical problems with it, and I felt it was something that could be done a lot better further down the line when we had, you know, more people, and that's kind of where it came in to meet Dana. I put the script together with someone else, another lad called John Giorgio, who came on board to kind of help rewrite some bits and get it back up to a decent point where we felt we could go into production with it. And then we came to Dana, who'd done some work before, and said, would you come on and produce it? And that's how we got together and kind of set up Northern Giant kind of professionally. From that film.
Dana, do you want to elaborate on
that? Well, yeah, it's just like Drew said, you know, at that point, I'd been working mainly on short documentaries, and I met Drew on this one documentary that I was working on, and from that, not long afterwards, he mentioned about Insomnia, and if I want to come on board in a producing role, which was something that was really interesting. I never thought of going into producing. But, you know, having got on really well with Drew and the chance to produce a short drama piece was interesting. And then reading the script, the whole thing about being a character-driven piece as well as being quite an artistic one was something that really pulled me in. So, we went from there, really, didn't we? And just kind of got it all together very quick, and then made a great short, I think.
Brilliant. So what were the inspirations for the original story?
Like I said before, it was to kind of delve into why the character, what had happened in the past that had made her the person they are, but from an audience point, to unravel that only in her memory. And that's how we kind of find out as an audience what has happened to her by her finding out that within herself as the film goes on. And also to kind of move away from doing a short film that's full of dialogue and... I kind of saw a lot of that, especially from university and then moving in and looking at other short films.
And it's so hard with short films because, you know, a lot of them, the dialogue's poor in short films. You know, it's normally just shoved together really fast. It's not natural. It's a lot of the time it's cliched. And it was a very, very definite decision to move away from that, wasn't it? I mean, even to the point where there was some dialogue and it was removed, which made it stronger.
Yeah, there was voiceover and dialogue and everything was taken out, so the script was completely... There was no dialogue in the script whatsoever.
I think that was a good decision about that. You know, it makes it more accessible as well, where the removal of the dialogue made you actually concentrate on the events itself as they unfolded instead of, you know, the words that surrounded it. It was all very much driven by what you were seeing, very visual.
And to have that experience as a viewer, that it could be any apartment, any person, mm-hmm. and it, you know, it was universal, and without having dialogue that could tie it to that.
Yeah.
And kind of an interesting thing for myself as well as a director to kind of push myself to do a film where I'm not relying on dialogue and try and completely just bring across emotion through the way that we can use the camera and from the performance from the actor.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that actually. I mean, was that a conscious decision to do it that way? Well, just to drive you to really find the images that stand out that really reflect Sarah's state of mind?
Yeah,
in the story.
Because of not having that dialogue to fall back on, you had to be kind of creative to kind of get your point across and to, like you said, to reflect the character's state of mind. I think that's just kind of my style as a director anyway.
Yeah.
I like to slow things down and kind of bring things, I don't know, the pace up at different points that reflect the character, and hopefully people can kind of relate to that when they see the film.
Yeah.
And we were very lucky to have Erin. From the minute she turned up that day, she's such a great person to have because, you know, such a strong character-driven piece, and you've got to have someone who can shoulder that. And we very much found that with Erin. And just to have on set as herself, she's such a fun, light person to be around, and everybody loves her. And then, but to see that transformation, how she can literally click her fingers, she can go into that character and also come out, and you wouldn't think that from the performance. You would think that she'd need to be in a dark room for an hour, don't talk to her, leave her alone. Nothing at all like that, was it?
No, it was. It's a complete switch.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, a difficult, I think, performance for her, but she just, you know, took it all in a stride, and to go to certain places that she had to do.
Mm.
And that we asked her to as well.
No problem for her at all.
She was a true professional.
Mm.
Yeah, excellent.
And it's a really good dynamic, I think, that Drew and Erin have working together. Mm. And, you know, that being, you know, the kind of issues involved in insomnia, it's really important that there's a massive trust element there between your actor and your director.
Mm.
And I think that was really evident within Insomnia. You know, you could see the trust that Erin had within Drew. And likewise, you know, he trusted her to deal with the piece. So, yes, a testament to both of them.
Excellent. Just going back to John doing the screenplay. Had John done work with you in the past, or made you go to him specifically to rewrite it?
No, not really. I know he was an aspiring writer. I was friends with him at work, and we discussed about films and had the same interests, and he really wanted to get into writing. And because I'd done Insomnia and had this script for a good 6 years or something, and kind of things got in the way, but it was something I really wanted to do. I just felt a bit too close to it, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
I couldn't better it because I needed fresh eyes to look at it, and so I gave it to him and said, "Will you, you know, come on board and help me rewrite it?" And that's what he did, and it went really well, and added some new ideas, and. So, yeah, that's kind of how John came on board with it.
Okay. So when you came aboard, John had already done the screenplay at that point?
Yeah, I think there's probably a couple of last-minute tweaks on it.
Mm.
But, yeah, John and Drew were working on it, and then I came on board. So it was quite, you know, a lot of new dynamics, really. Everybody learning to work with each other because, you know, we'd worked together, in a sense, in the same building, but not directly on a project where, you know, we were the kind of, you know, the three figureheads of it, the writer, director and producer. So it was interesting working together and like learning how people approach things and all that kind of stuff. But I don't think it changed that much when I came on board. I think you pretty much got it set how you wanted it. And the main thing was just removing the dialogue.
Mm.
But I think structurally wise, Drew got it to the point where he wanted it. And then, then we just started work on getting it ready.
Okay. I mean, did you... Obviously, the role of a producer is largely logistical.
Mm.
Did you feel like you needed to, or that you should, invest in it emotionally to a certain degree?
Well, I didn't really think about it at all, to be quite honest. Mm. I just wanted to... I thought if I ever thought it, I'd get just a bit kind of overwhelmed by it more than anything. Because like I said, it's a big job to take on board. And I think, especially with shorts as well, because, you know, you've got no money, you've got no budget, you're going to have to get everyone to do everything for nothing. So I think the minute you start thinking about it in terms of that, it just, you do question if you're mental and you should just step away. But I didn't. I just thought, oh, okay, yeah, right. They've asked me to do it. I like it. I want to do it. Where should I start? And that was pretty much the way we started. So the main things, first of all, were getting finding the cast and the location. So that was the way we approached it, really. Which was tough. As expected, like we said, again, you know, you've got to get everything depends on your actor.
Mm. Mm.
So that was a process, finding Erin, which involved us, you know, watching loads of show reels, trying to kind of reach for the stars with certain actors who thought I'd be good at it. And then it turned out where John just turned around and said, oh, yeah, yeah, my mate's sister's an actress. And we were like, all right. And it turned out to be Erin. And it was just like, all right, okay. So we're going to keep her in our pocket forever.
Yeah. Absolutely. In fact, because I saw a three-part pilot on Netflix, this thing called Residue.
Oh, right.
And she had a very small role in that.
Mm. Yeah.
She just popped up. I had no idea she was in it. And one of the producers on that had also produced another one of the short films, which is also on Cameo Launch as well.
Oh, right.
So there's all kinds of webs of contact going on there.
She's very good, Erin.
She is very good.
I always feel like a proud mum of Erin. Whenever she's in it, I'm like, oh, yes, Erin's in this. Erin's on that. Telling everyone. No, no one's really interested in me wailing on. I was like, yes, I know Erin.
I mean, was it hard to get her to either take on the role or to really go to the places you needed her to go to, it being as demanding as it was?
No, not really. No, not at all. Like I said, John said, you know, I've got my friend's sister's an actress. So told me her name, I had a look at her showreel online. And there was a piece from, I think it was Scott and Bailey, she was in Scott and Bailey, and there was a scene there where she absolutely loses it. And as soon as I saw her in that, I was just like, "This, you know, I'd do anything for this girl to be in the film." So John got the script to her, which is always nice when you can kind of get it to them directly, actors, and then take it from there. So yeah, we got a meeting together, and just based on the script, she wanted to do it. So for me, it was more just meeting her and seeing her as a person and discussing, you know, what my kind of take was on it and what direction we wanted to take it in, and she got on board with all that. And as far as, you know, directing her on set or pushing her in certain directions or asking her to do certain things, no, she'd take it wherever you would want it to go, and then come in with some ideas of her own, and you can work like that. And so, yeah, she's a joy to work with.
Mm. Yeah, excellent.
And we had a really great supporting cast as well. You know, we had... we had two great people in there, Garth and me, playing the cheating boyfriend, which was great, really, just because of the physicalities between them.
Yeah.
Because he's so tall.
Mm. Yeah, he's like 6'7", I think.
Yeah.
Right.
And then we've got Jenny in, playing the supposed mistress character. And that was lovely seeing that happen, because that was improvised, because obviously we had no dialogue. But we needed something.
Yeah.
And everyone just enjoyed watching that. That was the last day, wasn't it?
That was really good. Because I think Erin and Jenny knew each other a little bit as well. They were always
going for the same auditions.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when they both turned up. And they're like, oh, I know you. And I sat there just watching them. And it turned out that they always were up for the same roles, because they were both like the same hair colour, same age, same like physical appearance and everything. And they were just talking a load about jobs that they got, they didn't get. All that kind of stuff. So that's quite funny.
And it was good to see them when they were on set together then. And for the characters, it was more just to give them a bit of background. Well, to give Jenny a bit of background and of who she was playing, and then just kind of let them go free on it. Right. And even though it's just kind of one scene in the film, I really like that scene.
Yeah, really pulls things together.
Really good to see them two together as well, and to just do it ad lib.
Yeah, yeah, it's a pivotal scene as well. Mm. You need to understand the background of where the trauma starts, basically, because it's the kind of the catalyst for the main event.
Yeah, exactly.
That causes all of the trauma.
And it also kind of adds a different twist on it, the way they played it, where, you know, Jenny's character isn't, you know, the Scarlet Woman, almost. The way it's played, that she didn't know.
Mm.
You know, she's just as upset as when she found out. Mm. So it's a different take on how you react to him as well, which, as it develops not long afterwards, we see how the relationship comes to an end with them, don't we? And, you know, it adds more weight to it, I think.
Mm. Was there any particular reason why you didn't show the boyfriend's face as well?
Because everything that we're seeing is from the point of view of Sarah.
Mm.
And because of this trauma and the reality that she lives in when she's with, as an insomniac, she can't create that mental picture of his face, or has chosen to block his face out. So it was a conscious decision not to, unfortunately for Carl, the actor. But that was the point of it. Because we're seeing everything from her point of view, and she can't construct his face, and has chosen not to. So, and these are her flashbacks. So, not always can you take everything for that's fact in the flashbacks. It's her interpretation,
right?
Okay. And I think it looks great as well. Like you were saying about the height difference and stuff like that. It makes him more of a foreboding character as well, doesn't it? Like you're not seeing him, you're only seeing him from the back, and we're not getting to kind of humanise him at all because, like you said, it's her memories. So, yeah, it's interesting. I really like the stuff with him.
Okay. And, it all kind of feeds into the style that gets employed all the way through, because you've got some obvious visual styles. It's almost like she's being haunted in a ghostly kind of way by herself, in a way, and obviously her own memories. It was an interesting choice, actually, because if I was listening to it right, the flashbacks are playing out in, well, basically going forward, but the sound seems to be reversed on some of them. Is that basically what you do with them?
With the dialogue scenes with Jenny and things like that. And we brought Mark Kershaw, who did a fantastic job with the sound design.
Mm.
I think it's a real... that was a conscious decision as well at the start to really amplify the sounds and because, again, they're all inside Sarah's head and the reality that she lives in and what's going on. Nothing's quite real. And, Mark came up with some of them ideas for them, some of them reverse pitches and then whispers and things like that. So it's her mind kind of trying to rebuild these memories.
Right.
He did a great job.
Yeah, really good job.
Yeah, really just highlighted certain bits as well, which was with subtlety in this in the sound design. Great job he did with it.
Because the sound plays a very big part of the atmosphere and quite often doesn't get the recognition that it deserves. So, I mean, did you work out the sound design before you went into production, or was it something that kind of came about organically through the process?
Kind of organically, although I did have a few chats with Mark before and we discussed... we did discuss the ideas of what we wanted to implement with the sound design and then we just took that further in post-production. But I've always been a lover of sound anyway in film, and I think sometimes it can often get overlooked. And they always say, don't they, you know, you can never have terrible sound in your film. No. Sometimes you can get away with a few other things, but if you have bad sound, then...
Yeah, nobody ever notices good sound.
No. Yeah.
That's the pitfalls of being a sound guy, isn't it? You're never going to get recognition a lot of the time.
True. Unless you're Ben Burtt and you create the sound of a lightsaber, then no one's going to give you fair dues, unfortunately. Okay, I mean, in terms of the themes of the story as well, loneliness is an obvious one. Another one is sort of broken lives, in a way. So you've got that in kind of a hypothetical way with regard to the infidelity of the boyfriend, and then you've got it in a very literal way with the miscarriage as well. So how did you go about wanting to implement that kind of theme into it, or how did you want to tackle it when you wrote the story originally?
It all just stemmed from that idea of what had happened in her past and kind of rebuild the story from backwards going forwards, if that makes any sense. So yeah, the thing, it was just to show that we're all human and people make mistakes and people have relationships and these things can happen, and that there have to be a certain amount of extensive trauma or something that's happened in her past, you know, so bad that would kind of cause her to be in the state that we see her in from the start.
She's stuck in time, isn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, and how long can you allow that to go on for?
Mm.
You know, there's so many people where they do get completely absorbed by, like you were saying, a terrible experience, that they can't move on from it and it ends up destroying their life. But the majority of people have to kind of say no and put it aside at some point. And it kind of covers that, doesn't it, really? Her being able to deal with it, like you said, by reliving it all.
Yeah.
And acknowledging it.
Facing her past, yeah. Mm. Because she hasn't done that for long enough, and that's what's put her in that position.
Yeah, because it's only when you can accept into it that you can move on.
Yeah.
7 stages of grief.
Just going back to the styles that are employed, in terms of visual style, I've got a couple of instances where you see Sarah in the same shot several times, and at the very end you've got that long panning shot as well to her on one side of the room to the other. Do you find that quite often in shorts, particularly, when people have the ability to do stylistic stuff like that, they think style first and then story later? And have you ever been tempted to do the same thing once you've realised that you're capable of doing
something like that? I think you're always tempted to do more things, and sometimes you have to, you know, maybe stop and just have a look and have a think about, you know, is it to a point of the story to drive the story forward, to, you know, show the audience a different part of the character visually? So there was certain scenes that I'd seen in my head, and they were always going to be in, if you know what I mean. But that's only because I'd known the story for so long. But there is that, like you said, that danger, and I think I wouldn't want to be someone who's known for just throwing stylistic shots in for no merit or no purpose to the film. Which I thought the certain shots, like the panning one, and like you say, the one where there's different versions of herself, needed to be in there to tell that side of the character.
Mm.
And with shorts, again, you only get a limited amount of time.
I was gonna
say
that, yeah.
If you can do things in one shot, or you can, you know, try and be as creative as you can to tell the story. That's kind of how I look at it. Yeah.
And you know, you've got to be ruthless as well. You can't have loads of filler. Mm. In shorts. I mean, you shouldn't really have loads of filler in any films, really, but, you know, you've got to be ruthless with what is needed and what isn't needed. You know, is this driving the story? And if it's not, then you've got to look at it, haven't you, and think, can we get rid of it?
If you have a long, you know, 3-minute tracking shot and you think it looks amazing, and I've been in danger of doing that as well, and, you know, you need people around you need to get a good, you know, good people in the edit, producers, you know, everyone that you work with, to kind of sometimes say, you know, will this kind of work, or and give fresh eyes on it as well. Because, you know, you're not making a film on your own, you're making a film with everyone else as well, and you're just hoping that they're all on board to work for your vision.
I mean, for me, it very much reminds me of Kubrick and Lynch, which two of my favourite people. But yeah, there's a lot of scenes like the shot of her at the table. That's very Kubrick to me, and I love that. And you know, just the feeling, like at the very end scene in the bathroom, the transition of it, the way it turns, it reminds me of like stuff like Mulholland Drive and things. You know, the way the atmosphere changes, which is, you know, obviously down to the performance, direction, camera. And again, like Mark's amazing sound design completely changes the atmosphere of the piece.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it's a very stylish, artistic film, but at the heart of it, the story is there. And I'd say that the work that we do as Northern Giant, it's always got to be focused on the story, you know, completely. And I think that's when you've got to make the decision if you're an artist making short films or if you're a filmmaker making artistic kind of films, which I think there's a big difference, really, you know, the way you approach stuff. Yeah. And I think we make good films with an artistic eye. fame.
So you preempted one of my questions, actually. I was going to ask what your influences were and also what your challenges were. You kind of pretty much answered. So I skip ahead. So that's fine. So what have you found being the biggest challenges in terms of getting the film made and then seen afterwards?
Well, the location was so important for this. You know, and we've often said it's another character within this, and it's always cheesy, and I hate it when people say stuff like that. But it is true with this one. We found such a brilliant place. You know, for that, we went to Creative England, and Drew was having a look through, and he found some places. So we contacted the top three that we, like, look of. And the one that we eventually went for in this, the pictures look completely different. I think that was number three in your choices, but it wasn't the top one. So they were really old photos. So Drew was away on his honeymoon. So when he got back, we went to have a look at it, and it just blew us away. It was so clean looking. I think that's another thing that, like, with Insomnia, it's got a very clean, crisp feel to it. And I think that's a lot of that is also due to the location that we had. Right. And we went and looked at it, and then, you know, the amazing skyline we had, and these huge windows, and this very kind of modern living apartment. It was just fantastic.
Well, yeah, and it just fitted in with having the skyline out at the back and to show this bustling city that's outside, and it helped to kind of enhance her loneliness and her trappedness within the apartment, and it just gave it another edge, like you say. And yeah, we're really lucky to get somewhere
lucky
like that. It was
it was really central as well, wasn't it? Because one of the first things I noticed, actually, you could see the Palace Theatre outside.
It was opposite the corner house.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Above the Sainsbury's, right at the top, it was the penthouse. And the guys were great. They were really accommodating. They were just letting us do what they wanted. They were having a great time. They were enjoying us being there as well, which helped.
Which is rare when doing short films on set. Going into people's homes and, you know.
We were very aware of that, thinking, shit, you know, we can't mess anything up. We were thinking after ourselves, oh, God, you know, it'd be great if they're out all day because we don't want to upset them by them seeing what we're doing. They went out for a bit. Then they come back. They were having a drink. Playing disco music in between us getting all ready. So, you know, they always say, don't they, on films, like, deadly serious or stuff like that, where the atmosphere on set is really light. Well, it definitely was. It was on the run-up to Christmas, wasn't it? They'd been out Christmas shopping. Everyone was in good spirits.
And I think that's what helped with the making of it. And actually, on set, on, you know, the production-wise, it wasn't really difficult at all. It was...
Once we got the location...
All the crew were fantastic, you know, with brilliant location with the guys who owned the place, you know, were fantastic. And it just made it so much easier to, you know, have that freedom to then being able to just go, we can take our time on this. And where you constantly, you're feeling that clock ticking down of when you have to be out of a location. Yeah. And it made it kind of easy that way. So I think finding the place was the hard part.
Yeah.
Right.
Because you can contact places and some of the figures that they were giving us for 2-3 days to be in somewhere that needed to be big enough and kind of have that space for us to work in. We're really out of our budget completely.
Yeah. So we looked at a couple of those, you know, like those city apartments that you can rent. We had a look at one of them, and it was nice, and it was, you know, it was almost like a backup, because this was before you went away, when he was thinking, right, if we have to, we can. But
I think we got it a week and a half?
Yeah.
We actually got the location before we started filming.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, it was getting to a really
scale. Yeah, there was a lot of negotiating backwards and forwards with the guys who owned it. Because, I mean, I originally thought it was some kind of estate agents that owned it, but it was them directly, people who privately owned it and lived there, which was better.
Yeah.
You know, and they were just happy to have people there filming and... You know, it's good for them because then afterwards, obviously, they've got a film they can show to people, say, this is what was done here. But yeah, I think the most difficult thing for Insomnia was really finding Erin, finding the actress, and finding the location. And then when you get them, you're like, oh, yeah, it's fine. You know, I imagine everyone must feel like that. And it's only afterwards when you sit down and think, oh, shit, that was a bit close.
Yeah.
But yeah, it all turned out all right.
What have you found that there are a few challenges in terms of getting it seen by audiences in general, whether it be through festivals or individual screens or online or anything? What have you found your biggest challenges are there?
Festivals. We got in a few festivals, and it started to get to a wider audience now online. With you guys at Cameo, and so it's always hard though. I think with a film like this as well, it's kind of divides audiences, primarily for the subject matter, and we didn't kind of want to shy away from the themes, or and it can be seen as a little explicit, maybe. I don't know if that's the right word to use, but so I think with maybe festivals in with this film, it's hard to place it within a running order of films. I think that's what I kind of found with getting it seen.
But also, festivals have the criteria for every year. You know, it changes what they're looking for. But like Drew said, we did well with Insomnia. We got it into a few things. We drew right over to Palm Springs with it. We got it in Manchester. We won Filmed Up North Audience Award at the Corner House, now home. So, you know, it got out there, it got seen, which led on to other things like from the viewing at the Filmed Up North night, we got invited to go along to Grimfest and have it shown there. But even that, you know, like we were saying, it does split opinions because, you know, is it a horror? Is it a psychological drama? Is it a thriller? You know, where does it lie? And, you know, I quite like the fact that it can fit in different places. But, it's not easy to pinpoint what it is, I think, is the main thing.
I think you make films because you want to make films. You know, it's something, you know, you feel passionate about, and because it's not easy. You know, it takes a lot of work, and particularly, most people who are making short films now are making really good ones, and most of them are working full-time jobs and things like that, so it takes a lot of dedication. So you want to make the film that you want to make. I do personally. I don't look at it as what genre is this going to be, or
would I make this
for
this festival,
or make this for, you know, just make the film that you want to make, and then hopefully you know people have same taste as you might have.
It's surprising how many people do say. I've heard recently someone saying, "I want to make a short film and get it into Toronto," and you're like, "Well, what's that even mean?" You know, as you're saying, you want to be making a short film because you want to make that film, and then you see where it can fit into afterwards. No, I'm going to make a film for wherever. It kind of, what's the point? Just go and get a job at the festival if you're that bothered about getting there. Do you know what I mean? It's just, if you want to kiss the festival's arse and do that, but make a film for you, not for anybody else. And I think especially with Insomnia, because it was our first film working together as Northern Giant, it had to be a real calling card, and I think we really set out a store with it, and I think the rest of the films are going to follow in that line.
Excellent. Okay, so you're two films in now, so you've got Snatchers on the circuit at the moment, and are you looking forward to future projects?
Yep.
And what's on the cards there, if you can talk about
it? We can talk about it now.
We're kind of in pre-production on an adaptation that we're doing of a play. Which we can't really talk about too much at the moment.
No, it's still in development at the minute, but working with a local comedian.
Okay.
Adapting the stage play of his. So we're just in that point at the minute, you know, working through the script, changing it from a theatre piece to a screenplay.
Right.
So it's a lot of backwards and forwards with that. But with this one, you know, we don't want to go down, if we can help it, the kind of self-funding route, walking around, shaking, you know, swag bags in people's faces to get money off of. We want to go down the funding road and also get in with that kind of world as well. So, you know, we're going to be going through various funding bodies, see what we can get, see if we can get anything. So we're prepared to pace ourselves a bit with this one, aren't we? Instead of kind of go, right, we need to do this by then, that by then, that by then.
Because you get the bug, don't you? Once you make one, you want to make one straight away. Straight away. And with this one, and which was good to do, we did Insomnia, and then, and I think 5-6 months we did Snatchers.
Yeah, we did two films in a year completed.
Which was a lot of hard work, and it was nice now to get kind of go back to to go back into development with something and take our time and really nail down the scripts and then look at possible funding bodies, as you say.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said, we've done a lot, I think, in the, what is it, 2 years? 2 years? End of the year kind of thing. So, you know, especially like we had insomnia happen, and then we went into Snatchers pretty much straight away. But then logistically, things had to move up. We were planning to shoot Snatchers later on in the year, but we had to move that forward due to some of our actors' commitments. So we had to shift that forward, which meant we had to shift everything forward then. Mm-hmm. So we had to see if people were available, get funding quicker than we needed to. And that really was asking people for money. Just going around asking, but we got it.
Yeah.
And getting all our crew and everyone into place, and then, you know, location and all that crap. But we did it. But it was a real baptism of fire, I think, Snatchers.
Mm.
But in a good way, really, because I think we learned so much from it in every sense, from, you know, getting the film made to making the film, and then the kind of post-production side of it. We knocked it out pretty fast. So it was a massive learning curve for us. And it's won an award, you know, which is always nice. Cherry on the cake. Mm. So hopefully we'll continue well with Snatchers as we move into pre-production of the next one.
Excellent. So do you think you're at a stage now, or you might be in the not too distant future, where you might start working with other directors or other writers and bringing in existing projects to be produced within
the genre? We'd like to. You know, we've always said we don't want to be in exclusively just us, and if we don't like it, you know, it's our way of the highway kind of thing.
Mm.
We'd like to see other people's work, and, you know, I think that is ultimately the main goal, to be kind of doing our stuff, but also facilitating and working with other people.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because we know how hard it is, and if we ever get into that position, then geez, yeah, we'll definitely do that. But we're open to people sending us stuff to look at, writing-wise. And
yeah, definitely. And I think when, you know, everyone's making short films to hopefully then make features and to just try and push themselves into the industry, I think it's a massive community that you've got to be kind of part of.
Mm.
And that involves, you know, networking and going and seeing other short films and trying helping other people if you can, or, you know, and that can only come back to you in a good way as well. So, yeah, it's about, if someone came and wanted to do something with us, or a director who had a script and said, you know, I want you to come and help me produce this or make this, then if it's something that kind of is in line with what the kind of films we want to make, then yeah, I'd be really happy with that. Yeah,
excellent. And lastly, I mean, with film in general, especially in the UK, being in what you can only really call its biggest state of flux for a really long time, with the amount of different ways there are to consume content and films, be they short or feature or whatever. What would you advise filmmakers at the moment, based on your own experiences, just in terms of what to make or what to expect once they've made their initial project or their pet project or anything like that?
I'd just say shut up and get out there and make them. How many people sit around talking about how they've got a great idea and they want to do this and they want to do that? Well, go and do it. People have got facilities available to them now. They're not necessarily the best things in the world, but most people can get hold of a camera. If not, film on your phone if it's that good an idea. If the story's that strong, get out there and film it. I'm sick of hearing people whinging on about how they want to make a film and they never do it. We hear it all the time, don't we? We do it.
Mm.
So, and there's loads of outlets now, like you were saying, this Cameo and various sites like that. There's loads of festivals, there's loads of short film nights. You know, the internet's rife with getting it out there. But there's just no money in it. That's what you've got to look at. Remember, you're not going to make money out of it, but it could lead on to you doing something that eventually will help your career and help you make money.
And I think there's nothing better than making your first film and even getting it into, you know, a short film night, because they're going all over the country, you know, there's shooting people, meetups, and there's things like that, and, you know, little screenings where, you know, you might not have the best production values or anything, but, you know, people will come and people will watch it, and you learn a hell of a lot about yourself as a filmmaker when you sit in a room with an audience and they watch your film. But then also on that is just to keep making your films and don't get downhearted on, because there's a lot of people out there all making films, and you know, if you start thinking about it like that, then it kind of it can scare you into not you know, not wanting to put yourself out there thinking, well, there's another 1,000 people have entered that film festival, why will mine get picked? Or just to kind of believe, you know, what you're doing is what you want to do and the kind of films that you want to make. And yeah, and like Dan said, just go out and, and make them and meet people and network with people, and because that's how you find your crew and things like that. You know, you go. I started off doing boom operating just by finding jobs on Mandy.com, just to get a like, you know, see what it's like to be on a set and how things work. And so yeah, like with the internet and all the outlets, you know, you've got everything at your disposal now, which I think you probably never had before.
Right.
So yeah, just go out and make a film.
Yeah, you just got to, if you believe in your idea and you believe that it's a story that you'd want to see told, then there's going to be somebody else out there who feels the same. And yeah, you've just got to go and make it, you know. And if people don't like it, well, bleep out what I'd say, because I don't care. You know, I'm very much like that. If people don't like it, then somebody else will, and just keep moving on and moving on until somebody else likes it. And they will. And you've just got to be a bit bullish about, I think, and protective of your idea, and just think, yeah, I want to make it.
And you get better. You'll get better every time you make a film. You know, very few people, I think, make, you know, the first film, and unless you're the guy who made Whiplash or something like that. Who's, you know, there's not many people who, you know, do that straight away. And and so you've just got to think every time you make a film, you're like, right, what did, you know, what went right, what went wrong, what can I learn from that experience?
And exactly.
And for me, I'm learning more about like the distribution side of it now, which, and you know, you don't really think of when you first make a film, but that comes with time. And I just say, if people are new to it, it's just go out and make your film. Yeah.
And there's loads of like things out there. Like a lot of independent cinemas have nights on where, not necessarily just film screening nights, but where you can go and meet people who talk about distribution. We went something like that last year at the Corner House Cinema. Real insight on how the actual industry works at that level, you know, and it was on feature films, but it's interesting to hear how it works, and also in the way that short films are also looked at. But you know, there's that much information out there. There's, you know, not necessarily you don't have to think of it, well, you know, I don't necessarily want to be a producer, a director, or a writer. If you want to be doing sound, or if you want to edit and everything, well, then look for projects where you can get on board, and you know, you can find things. But the most important thing, if you want to do it, then do it. Don't wait for someone to ask you.
Brilliant. It's a fine piece of advice to end on. Right, thank you very much, guys. That was really great. Anyone who has not yet watched Insomnia, What Have You Been Doing? Go watch it right now. And we look forward to Snatchers once it's done and out for circulation as well. But thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Cheers.
Writer-director Drew Levitt and producer Dana Bruce. Well, that's all we have time for in this edition. To check out Insomnia or any of the films on Cameo Launch, please go to www.cameolaunch.com/movies. Don't forget to leave your comments and a star rating. You can also subscribe to our mailing list to stay updated on new movies, updates on our filmmakers and actors, and to catch our next edition of In the Green Room, where I'll be speaking to Jamie Sims, writer-director of romantic drama Bus Stop. Don't forget to share this podcast with your friends, and we look forward to catching you next month. Thanks a lot for joining us.